Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Here's a question for you to ponder over while the program goes. Can early childhood adversity and stress, things like exposure to substance abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, determine that infant or child's lifelong risk for mental and physical health? On this program, Josh Arvidson, who is director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center at the Anchorage Community Mental Health Services, and I will be discussing the evidence for this kind of proposition. The Alaska Trauma Center, incidentally, specializes in treating young children who have experienced complex trauma. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, there are a couple of ways to get a hold of us, and we'll continue to give you this information throughout the program. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email us during the next hour at our email address, which is line1, and you have to spell that out, all as one word, at alaskapublic.org. Josh, it's a pleasure to have you back again.
Well, thank you.
So we're talking about some early childhood experiences and the evidence for lifelong consequences. And I would like to start by just taking our listeners into what we know about the nervous system and the brain in particular of infants and asking some basic questions, which maybe everybody knows, but maybe we need to put it in some broader perspective. So can infants from birth learn, and what's the evidence to that?
Absolutely, they can learn. And when we think about learning in early childhood development, particularly for a conversation about adversity, we have to take a developmental perspective. And often when people think about learning in childhood, they think about ABC 1-2-3 type of learning, but we're learning a lot, especially in the first couple years of life. And it's not just the sort of cognitive or academic sort of preparation kind of learning. It's also we're learning about our world. We're learning about the people around us, and we're learning how to interact with the world. And we're learning about ourselves. And that starts happening right at birth. Mm-hmm. And progresses throughout early childhood. So when you think about adversity cutting across that experience, we really have to take a developmental perspective.
Give us some examples so that we can appreciate the fact that that learning is going on in however way you want to use examples of that.
Okay. So I'll use an example that anybody who's been around little kids can probably think about, or any parent can think about. If you imagine a six-month-old baby who's hungry, so she starts crying because she's hungry, and then think about what happens in the next couple minutes. So someone hears that cry, and parents are pretty good at this, especially with their own kids. They know that's the hungry cry or the right. tired cry. Sometimes it's a process of elimination, but mm-hmm. they respond to that. You know, they feed the baby. And it's interesting if you observe parents with babies, they don't just feed the baby. They also rock the baby, comfort the baby. And so the baby gets fed, and her distress goes down, and she feels better. And that's a real simple interaction that's happening dozens of times every day, and different variations of that are happening hundreds of times every day mm-hmm. in a child's life. And what's happening there is more than just the baby getting fed. The baby is learning some fundamental things about the world, about other people in the world, and about themselves. So if you think about that little interaction, you know, the baby started off feeling distress, right? Her tummy may be hurt. And so she has an ability to externalize that distress, so she cries, right? She's probably not thinking, you know, at 6 months, you know, it's been 3 hours since I ate, and, you know, mm-hmm. she doesn't know about calories and all that sort of thing. But she's sort of programmed to be able to externalize that distress. And then the caregiver attunes to that and responds to that distress, and not only meets the baby's physical need by feeding her, but also comforts the baby. So what's happening is the baby's experiencing distress, and then someone is coming in and alleviating that distress or mediating that distress. And this is really important when we think about stress and babies, which is that the caregiver is really not only the source of meeting the physical need, but also of helping the baby deal with the emotional distress. And so that baby is learning a couple things. You know, attachment researchers would say she's developing working models or templates for how she understands the world. She's learning that the world is basically a safe and predictable place, that other people are good and they're going to meet her needs and respond to her. And she's also learning that her own distress is something that will pass and is not overwhelming. So even at 6 months, she's learning a whole lot, even just in a simple interaction like mm-hmm. that.
And that you, because you're more the mental health aspects, that's the emotional, social emotional development.
Right.
And I think that's really critical because so many parents don't appreciate that. They may see that baby learns to stick their tongue out when you stick your tongue out at them pretty early, and they follow you as they develop over the first several months with their eyes. So all these physical things that are happening are a little bit more obvious, but this social emotional development, which we're going to spend so much time on today, is really going on at the same time.
Absolutely. It's pretty profound when you think about it, because if you think about that baby a little bit later, let's say she's 3 now and she's hungry again, and what can she do? Well, she might be able to say she's hungry. But my question would be, well, how does she know she's hungry? Well, because her tummy hurts. But how does she know my tummy hurts means I'm hungry? Because she's been fed hundreds and hundreds of times over and actually had it reflected back to her, mirrored by her caregiver. So that ability to even know what she's experiencing internally, that social, emotional, developmental piece is really dependent on that caregiver. Mm-hmm.
In the sum of the environment, I mean, we don't always
Absolutely.
Think, I mean, caregiver is one part, whoever that yeah. may be or whoever they may be, but there's lots of things going on in the environment. She may see other people in the environment and how they're interacting with the caregiver.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everyone in that child's world has an influence on that, on their development, particularly their social mm-hmm. and emotional development.
So the point here is, just like they're learning to control their body physically, and there's a direct way that happens, head down, trunk out, there's a definite sequence. But at the same time, there's a social-emotional development ongoing, and that's what we want listeners to understand as we get into this program a little bit further today. We already have a phone caller, and it looks like it has something to do with about environmental factors, so I'm going to take that call. Nikki, you're on line one.
Yes, mine's more about, less trauma from the parents, but more from the school, peers, teachers. I'm on the autistic spectrum and got beat up, picked on, a lot of mental and physical abuse from siblings, from kids at school. And
right.
now as an adult, I have something called dermatillomania, where it's like a compulsive skin picking.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
kind of a generalized anxiety disorder as well.
Right.
And my parents were great parents, but that trauma I received every day, K through 12, I think led to this.
Right. All right. Well, let's ask Josh what he has to say about that.
Well, I thank you for your call. And I think that just reiterates the point that you just made, Dr. Woodard, about everyone in a child's life having an influence and an effect on that child. And so, when I use the word caregiver, I think it is important to think about this is everyone that is involved in a child's life can have a really powerful influence and impact.
And this gets directly to this emphasis now in schools on bullying and the effects that can have on individuals. Is that kind of what you're also implying, Nikki?
Yeah, absolutely. I came from a small town, and being different really made you stand out. The bullying was pretty severe. I mean, I was stabbed by sticks and broken. I had a couple bones broken. I had minor concussions. Just pretty severe beatings as a child from these kids, and it's just it caused this kind of a fear, this kind of anxiety. Even now today, I'm learning to deal with.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about that starts right in infancy and can have some lifelong consequences. It doesn't have to start there, as you've already alluded to, but early in childhood, there's all this development going on. And so that gives us a good opportunity to take that idea. So thanks, Nikki, for your call.
No problem.
Before we ask about what we know about stress and anxiety and worry and trauma, let's talk, if you can, a little bit, Josh, about what's happening at the brain level. So we now know these things happen, and the advances in neuroscience are allowing us to actually quantify and document what's going on. Can you talk about that?
Definitely. There's a it's been really an explosion of brain research in the last 20 years that looks at how stressful events or experiences impact the brain. And I'll point particularly to brain imaging studies that have looked at when we experience a stressful event, really our brain responds in some pretty powerful ways. And we're all familiar with how our body responds. You know, if you're fishing along a river and a grizzly bear comes out of the bushes, we all know what happens in your body. Your heart rate goes up, your, you know, respiration, muscle tension, all these responses kind of happen in your body. At the same time, there's a response that we can't see as well, but is happening in the brain, which is activation of what we call the alarm system. And it's primarily housed in the limbic system in the brain. And this is sort of the emotional center of the brain. And this alarm system response works in partnership with the response in our body to enable us to, you know, fight, flight, or freeze, to respond to that stress in a powerful way. Now, some things that are particularly pertinent about this research is that when we're in that alarm system response, we actually see decreased metabolic activity in the frontal cortex, the sort of thinking centers of the brain, the problem-solving cognitive sort of centers of the brain. And that makes some sense when you think about it. If a grizzly bear is coming out of the bushes, you know, algebra. And
you don't want to reason about this. You want to get the hell out of that.
No, you know, the Gettysburg Address or whatever you learned in seventh grade isn't going to be that helpful. Your
right,
body is.
Right.
And that's really important to think about, because we talk about stress as something that can be toxic and overwhelming. But at its core, our response to stressful events is not psychopathology. It's part of what enables us to survive as human beings. What we think is problematic about overwhelming stress or chronic stress or stress, overwhelming stress early in the lifespan, is that it's sort of, you think about it like a fire alarm. It's sort of like that fire alarm handle has been pulled so hard or so many times that it's sort of hanging off the wall, and all it takes is a little passing breeze to set that alarm system off. Mm-hmm. And people who experience post-traumatic stress talk about this, about being kind of on constant edge or constant alert. And Nikki was talking about this as well, the last caller, about sort of always being on edge and searching the environment for danger. And we think that that is a normal response that an alarm system that's pulled over and over and over again makes to adapt.
And as a response, and I'm sure going to talk about this, or I think we'll talk about it a little bit more, as you've already alluded to, while that's going on, if it's happening in school, for example, your ability to learn while all that's going on is affected.
Absolutely.
Because you're spending your emotional and intellectual capacities thinking about the stress, not responding to the educational efforts that are being made.
Absolutely. Julian Ford, one of the most interesting researchers in this area, talks about how trauma turns a learning brain into a surviving brain. And I always think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one way I think about it is when that stress response is going on, off, you know, learning is impaired. I sort of think about it as trying to learn chess while the fire alarm is going off. You're not going to be successful because the brain is oriented towards survival in that state. And when this happens chronically over and over and over again, we know that learning is often sacrificed for these more survival-oriented mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. And I know it also can affect our emotional centers, but we need to get back to that. I want to back up just a second, and since we're already into this chronic stress period, and we've hopefully had people that are listeners to realize that there is a lot of learning right from the get-go, and in fact, there's pretty good evidence babies learn in utero, and evidence is that is the preference for female voices after being born versus male. The fact that often a German baby has a different inflection in their cry than a French baby, implying that they've not only heard, but they've adapted their vocal intonation before they're born, right at birth. So there's quite a bit of evidence that the nervous system of an infant is ready to learn. But we're now talking about some of the emotional aspects that not everybody really it's not so clear and so evident. So now what we want to do is talk about stress. You've implied that there's some stress hormones and so forth. So let's go through this stress reaction a little bit more so we can relate back to what's going on in the brain a little bit more detail too.
Yeah. So, well, when we think about stress in social emotional development, one of the things that we know happens is when infants, toddlers, or young children experience overwhelming distress. You know, they're basically forced to deal with what we call sort of chronic states of dysregulation, which is that they're, if you think about your energy, you know, your body on operating on a 1 to 10 scale in terms of like alertness or energy level. And when kids are in chronically stressful environments, they're having to deal with a situation that it's a 9 all the time. And kids adapt to that in some pretty powerful ways. So when kids are faced with overwhelming distress, they'll adapt in ways to try to regulate their system. And so we'll see kids sometimes dissociate or disconnect or engage in sort of attempts to self-soothe, like rocking or sucking or those sorts of repetitive behaviors to try to regulate their system. Those are sort of adaptations that we see and signs often that a child's trying to deal with a system that's overstressed.
My understanding is also as the brain is developing, neurons are making connections. These cells we call the cells of our body, brain, part of them are neurons. And those are beginning to interact with each other. They get stimulated, the crosstalk and so forth. And when they're not stimulated, the brain actually prunes those things away. Again, kind of an energy conservation mechanism. And that's why, for example, making sure babies can see and hear at birth is important. If it's discovered later, then it may be too late to make any significant any judgment. But anyway, so these brain cells are being stimulated. They're making more and more and more connections. So there's actually changing in hard wiring, if you permit me to use that word, based on the external experience.
Absolutely.
And how often that happens, how much it gets reinforced is the medical term perhaps, more and faster those circuits, so to speak, work.
Absolutely. So there's a Martin Teicher at Harvard, Bruce Perry, Frank Putnam, a number of researchers have looked at this, and it's generally called prioritization of stress pathways. So what we see in kids who are being exposed to chronic stress is a prioritization of those, you're talking about, neuronal stress pathways in the brain. And in some instances, some sacrifice of other neuronal pathways in the brain. And the way I think about this is we think of kids' brains as being different from adults in some pretty important ways. So it's not just that their brains are smaller and they don't know a lot of stuff. Their brains are actually fundamentally different than adult brains. And, you know, a way of thinking this is if you or I were to try to go into a French immersion program tomorrow, and a 5-year-old were to go into a French immersion program tomorrow, a year out, the 5-year-old is going to be speaking way better French than you or I, because their brain is sort of built to learn language in a way that adult brains are not as good at. And so when we think about stress, this is really, you know, kids are resilient, but they're also particularly vulnerable to stress because in some ways their brains are organizing around their experiences. And so if their experiences are primarily stressful, their brains in some ways are becoming superhighways for those stress pathways. And that can have sort of lifelong implications and learning implications.
Remind our listeners once again, my guest today is Joshua Arvidson. He's director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center at the Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. And what we're doing is discussing the evidence and theory and mechanisms behind the fact that it is increasingly evident that adverse experiences and stress, even in very early childhood, can have lifelong consequences for mental as well as physical health. If you've got questions or comments, let me give you a couple of phone numbers and an email address that you can send us over the next 50 minutes or so. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And you have to spell out line one as all one word. So during this stress release, you said there's hormones. This is the adrenaline that people secrete and other things that are affecting not only our peripheral body but also our brains in various ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that, if it happens long enough, can lead to consequences that are more kind of normal responses that we end up spending lots of time, and it can make physical changes in the brain. We know that some of these neurons and parts of the brain may be affected in size and function even, as some of the neuroscience that I've been reading about, which is very exciting kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we want to do things right from the get-go. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
We have a question here that's somewhat related, may not be exactly, but I wanted to talk about the hormones just a little bit before I brought this up. And this is a lady who, or a man, I'm sorry, who has written in. It says, my son has difficulty making eye contact while speaking to individuals. He's a great public speaker, however. I'm interested in learning more about how the connection between oxytocin deficiency and a child and remedies to this. So there's a lot of information coming out about oxytocin. I'm not sure I have any answer for this gentleman, but I wanted to get that out there. Oxytocin is one of the hormones that we're learning has very significant effects on our emotions in particular. Any thoughts about this question?
I'll leave that one to you.
Yeah, and I don't know answer to that either. The eye contact issue seems to be an issue that sometimes is related to autistic-like phenomenon. I think it's not unusual to see happen to kids. I think it's easy to overreact to what that's really telling us. It may be, in certain times, a learned behavior, and I suspect very easily it can be rewarded and made to change with some very good, I'm going to call it behavioral modification, is a simplistic term. Now, would you somewhat agree with that, Josh, or are we still... am I saying things that you don't agree with or you don't have enough understanding of this problem?
I would agree with that. I mean, something like that, I think, consulting with their pediatrician or healthcare mental health provider to really look, try to get an assessment of what's going on. Because something like that, like eye contact problems, I think you hit the nail on the head. There's lots of different factors that could that could drive that. So.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean a person has autism.
Not necessarily.
Although that might be the underlying question here. I'm not sure.
Could be.
All right. Let's take another call. We've got another caller on line 7. Allison, what can we do for you?
Hi. I was just curious if you could speak to the comorbidity or correlation between experiencing childhood trauma and an ADHD or ADD diagnosis.
That is a very good question.
Yeah.
Sorry, did I cut you out? I wanted to say it's a very good question so fast. So, yeah, what's she talking about?
Yeah, so it's a complicated question, but I've got some thoughts about it. Through something called the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, our center, along with over 50 centers across the country, have been able to look at 20,000 kids that we treat across all these trauma centers. And we see some interesting things. This issue of comorbidity is really important. As kids experience more and more adverse events or traumatic events, the likelihood of them being diagnosed with mental health conditions goes dramatically up. Also, the likelihood of them being diagnosed or meeting criteria for multiple mental health conditions goes up. So this issue of comorbidity is really important. In terms of ADHD, for kids with high levels of exposure to trauma, ADHD is one of the top 5 mental health diagnoses that we see in our data set of over 20,000 kids. Now, you know, from a clinical perspective, it's a complex question because differentiating, you know, trauma-related symptoms from the hyperactivity or difficulty with the impulse control or attention that's, you know, critical to understanding ADHD is really a complex sort of clinical question, but it's an answerable question. So, or it's a question that can be addressed. So we would look at things like, does the hyperactivity or impulsivity, is it specific to certain situations or stressful situations or changes in the environment, or is it sort of always in the background, always running? Because those would be sort of the differential questions we'd start to look at to try to separate out something that's more stress-related or trauma-related or something that's sort of more like an ADHD that's sort of wired in.
Allison, what I'm hearing Josh say in response to your question is that especially in very young preschool children, at least those of us who are pediatricians, you have got to be extremely careful with this diagnosis of ADHD because many things such as childhood traumas, experiences, stress can look very much like that. Mm-hmm. One differential question is what he's pointed out, is it happened in different environments, only in school or only at home, or is it rather pervasive and there all the time, which may help us decide whether it's more ADHD, which would be more pervasive thoughtfully, because there seems to be clearly a genetic basis to that particular problem. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, I think so. So if it's more situational, then you'd probably lean towards more of a trauma.
Well, you got to keep an open mind. There's no reason why both problems can't exist either.
Yeah.
No, that's why it gets very, 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 very difficult, to say the least, and why we got to be very careful with these diagnostic criteria. And it's probably part of the reason why the diagnosis of ADHD is increasing so much in the use of medications, is it doesn't mean that it's appropriate in all those times. It's still, it's a tough situation. Josh, I don't want to overstay. If I'm looking at it from a pediatric standpoint, yeah, it can be very problematic on what you do with these.
We look at it from the mental health perspective. I would just echo your what you just said, which is that something like, take impulsivity, for example. You know, we know that when kids are experiencing a lot of stressful situations, they're at risk for impulsivity. So whether that impulsivity is more stress-related or anxiety-related, mm-hmm, or whether it really is ADHD is, like you said, something, a conclusion we can't jump too quickly.
Yeah. And I'm a person who has seen dramatic improvement with treatment with medications. And nobody likes to talk about medications for kids with ADHD. And so when I see kids not respond, it raises lots of red flags about what's really going on, and have a missed diagnosis and so forth. So everybody needs to keep an open mind about both the treatment of ADHD and the misdiagnosis of ADHD, particularly in the preschool age kids, particularly in that group, I would say, is where it gets very difficult.
What would you recommend if you did treat for ADHD and they didn't respond to medication, like therapy or...
Yeah, I'd really want, ideally, I'd like to have lots of money so I can really understand what's going on, which is get into the real world. Is talking to this family about, is there clearly a family history of other problems that are suggestive of that? And there's no reason why both processes can't be going on in the household. And as funny or as difficult as it is for parents to accept, sometimes a mental health evaluation with somebody who's really good at this can really help us to figure out where we are on the as far as a diagnosis. So let me, again, that's kind of a quick answer, but increasingly we in pediatrics and in private practice, general practice, we're trying to integrate more the mental health aspects for many of these same reasons, is to try to really decipher out the complexity of what appears to be a physical health problem from a psychosocial or a mental health problem.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much for answering my question.
Hope I didn't overwhelm you. So what I'm saying is they can be very confusing, especially in the preschool age child.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Josh, I can't believe it. It's already halfway through this hour, and I want to talk about a lot of the work you're doing. So I'm going to take my normal break here, and we'll come back and get into this a little bit more detailed about what we can offer children who may be experiencing some of these effects. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. You can also call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 and email at line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our conversation with Joshua Arvidson. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Joshua Arvidson. He's director of the Alaska Center for Trauma, the Alaska Child Trauma Center at the Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. And we're discussing the effects of early childhood stress and adverse experiences, such things as substance abuse, physical abuse, and domestic violence. And maybe we ought to elucidate some of those things we're talking about a little bit better here, Josh, but what those things can do as far as having lifelong consequences on both mental and physical health. If you've got questions, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Also, please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, so we can't answer your questions. But also remember that at any time, you can go to our archives at alaskapublic.org, look for the Line 1 archives, and listen to past programs so you can recommend people listen that you think should be listening and would benefit from programs like this. So before we move on, let's do talk about the significant kinds of adverse effects that we're really worried about in your job.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a good starting point is to talk about, you know, we've used words like stress, trauma, toxic stress to kind of define those a little bit for folks because, you know, a stressor, something that stresses us, stressors are common. And in fact, you know, a small amount of stress is not actually bad for us. In fact, it can be good for us. Very small amounts of stress or manageable amounts of stress. The way I always think about this is exercise. Exercise is a way of stressing your body. If it's done in moderation, it actually can make you quite a bit stronger. But, you know, overwhelming stress, if you were to go out and try to run a marathon tomorrow with no training, you'd just injure yourself. So when we're talking about toxic stress or traumatic stress, we're talking about stress that overwhelms the individual's capacity to cope. That's what we're talking about. It overwhelms the physiological system, the body, and the brain. And I think that's important to keep in mind because, when we talk about trauma, we're not talking about all stress or minor stressors. We're talking about things that are overwhelming to the individual.
And the other thing I think we ought to talk about, and then I want to get to what's called the ACEs study, which is a pretty predominant study that's looked at these long-term effects. But before we do that, we should, I think, point out that there are individual differences. It's the way we think about almost everything in health now is there's a genetic tablet with which the environment is writing on. And so some people can handle stress better than others. Some handle one kind of stress handle better than others. There's tremendous variability. And even it gets complicated because the environment may improve the ability of people to handle stress if it's done right.
Right. Right. I mean, the literature on when you talk about with resiliency
right.
and people's individual responses is so fascinating. That's why, you know, a clinical definition or a working definition of traumatic stress that we use is that it's something that overwhelms the individual. Mm-hmm. So you really have to understand traumatic stress from the perspective of an individual because two people can go through the same situation. Right. One finds it overwhelming, one doesn't. So, factors that determine an individual's response to a stress are really almost infinite.
Mm-hmm. However, studies like the ACEs study, yeah. which let's talk about, what is that all about, show that there's a significant risk to certain stresses early in life that right. can have lifelong consequences. It doesn't mean everybody, doesn't yeah. mean it's written in stone for the rest of your life, but it does point out some important things. So tell me about the ACEs study.
Yeah, so the ACEs study, ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. This was a study done in 1997 by Kaiser Permanente and the Center for Disease Control. And what they did, it was done by an epidemiologist a preventive medicine specialist. And the question that they're asking with this research is, do traumatic experiences or adverse experiences in childhood have health consequences for adults? So in other words, if someone's exposed to adverse experiences during childhood, can you see those effects even 10, 20, 30, 40 years later in terms of health outcomes? And the ACE study is a very powerful study. They looked at 17,000 adults. and they screened for 10 different types of trauma exposure, exposure to domestic violence, incarceration of a parent, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse. And what they did is they looked at the relationship between exposure to those types of events and long-term health outcomes, and they found very strong correlations between adverse childhood experiences and long-term health outcomes.
And what were some of the – I was looking at an email, so if I'm making to say something again, I apologize here. What were some of the stressors or the adverse effects that were being monitored?
Yeah, so they started with a real simple list of just 10 questions. So they looked at, like, exposure to domestic violence is one of them. Okay. Physical abuse is one of them. Sexual abuse is one of them. Incarceration of a parent was one of them. Mm-hmm. Violent death of a parent was another. So
how about illegal substance abuse within the house?
Yeah,
was that
parental
one?
Substance abuse was one
that,
of them.
That's an, to me, that's an important one as a pediatrician.
Yeah.
Because I think I see that perhaps more than any, I worry about that more than any even physical abuse that's going on in child's halls.
Yeah, I really do worry about it too. It's a driver, you know, there's a couple different ways of looking at it, but in a lot of different studies, parental substance abuse is a driver or a predictor of exposure to other types of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a common, what we call etiological factor, causal factor. And when there's substance abuse in the home, the risk for exposure to multiple adverse events for a child really goes up. And that's mm-hmm. really important because the ACE study showed is that most of us, over half of the population, have experienced an adverse childhood event. Most people experience trauma in their lives. What the ACE study pointed to is that when we see chronic exposure to multiple types of trauma, that's where you really start to see the detrimental health and mental health impacts. And so that's part of why parental substance abuse is such a concern, because when it's parental substance abuse is present in the home, we see an elevation of ACE scores for kids. And when I say ACE score, what they did is they actually, if you answered yes to one of those questions, you would have an ACE score of 1. If you answered yes to 2, you'd have an ACE score of 2. And so on. And what they saw was when ACE score started to climb to 3, 4, 5, they saw a real elevation of risk throughout the lifespan.
What kind of risks?
So this is what's sort of surprising, because you would think, you know, obviously risk for mental health issues, but they even saw risk for things that we think of as more physical ailments. So they saw increased risk of obesity, increased risk of cardiac disease, increased hypertension, things that, you know, wouldn't think of as being so obvious. And when they looked at behavioral risk, then we saw a huge, huge elevation. So, for example, when they look at ACE scores and lifelong risk for suicide attempt or substance abuse, huge, huge correlations there. So, you know, as ACE scores climb to 4, 5, 6, you know, many-fold time risk in substance abuse, a lifetime risk for suicide attempts, or other sort of behavioral or mental health outcomes.
All right, so let me sum up where we are, because I want to make sure people are on task here. Children are learning early. They're learning not only physical control of their body, they're learning social and emotional aspects. And the more a certain system of your brain is stimulated, social, emotional, physical, whatever, the better it gets, the more ingrained it becomes. It's almost like there is a hard wiring that goes on. And so with stress and chronic exposure to adverse events, we now have pretty good evidence that has led, the more of these adverse effects, the more we can see behaviors apparently change and long-term health consequences perhaps as related to that behavior. That's one possible mechanism by which this would happen. So the brain, I'm trying to tell my patients more and more, and you got to tell me if I'm wrong, your brain's great at learning. It's not very good at unlearning. So if a baby's growing up learning how to do things, or this is the way people interact, or this is substance abuse is what goes on in my house, and fighting and yelling and screaming and nobody responding to my needs, I'm going to grow up thinking that's the way things are.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
and I'm going to need help, and I don't like this, and I may not learn so well, and I may start overeating, and I may do experimental drug use myself, and I'm looking for help.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about adverse experiences is it's not a death sentence. It doesn't
right.
mean it's going
right.
to predict your individual outcomes, but I mean, the data is pretty compelling mm-hmm. that these exposure to these types of events has real real physical and mental health outcomes. And, you know, subsequent to the ACE study, some later studies that have looked at sort of, you know, if there's a relationship between adverse experiences in childhood and long-term health outcomes, what happens in between? What are some of the mechanisms, as you were talking about, that transmit this impact? And so one interesting study that's hasn't even been published yet, but done by Chris Blodgett at Washington State University, looked at the relationship between adverse childhood experiences and school performance. And he shows pretty compelling data that when kids are experiencing adverse experiences at home, their school performance goes down, their rate of graduation goes down, their truancy goes up. And so we can see impacts even during development, not necessarily just in adulthood.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can spend the last third of this program or so talking about some of the research you've done and how you've addressed kids who've come into the system after being identified as having been exposed to adverse experiences.
Yeah. So there's a couple things we think about when we're working with kids who've experienced trauma. And we talked about it a little bit earlier, which is this idea of resiliency. And I think it's an important thing to keep in mind that most of us do experience adverse events in our life, and most of us are able to recover, and resiliency is more the rule than the exception. And so when we're thinking about treatment, we're always starting with resiliency. What are the components of resiliency? What are the ways we can work on resiliency? And the starting point in working with kids around resiliency is working with the caregiving system, working with the parents and all those people who are responsible for taking care of a child to build resiliency into that system, into that interaction, because that's really the foundation.
How do you do that?
Oh, boy, that's a big question. But we have, I have some thoughts about it. This is one of the primary treatment approaches that we think about is something called ARC, Attachment Self-Regulation Competency. It's developed by Christine Kinneberg and Margaret Blousey and Trauma Center at Justice Resource Institute back in Boston. But it has a couple different components. The first is thinking about attachment, thinking about what the relationship between a child and, I'll say, their caregiver, primarily parent, but anyone who's responsible for caring for a child, and thinking about building resiliency into that relationship. And so we have kind of four things we focus on. One is, we call it caregiver management of affect, which is sort of a clunky term, but it's working with caregivers and parents to help them understand how their responses to the child are the most important thing. It's the most important thing. And so, when we think about caregivers managing our own affect, how we respond to kids, being a calm and positive presence in kids' lives. I mean, it sounds sort of, mm-hmm. almost simple, but it's really, really the heart of building resiliency in kids, because kids look to their caregivers to moderate, or we call it mediate, stress. And you see this all the time. When kids experience a stressful event, they run to their parent, right? They run to their caregiver. I mean, even a little mm-hmm. minor stressor like skinning, mm-hmm. If you're with a 5-year-old who skins their knee, what do? They run mm-hmm. to mom or dad or to their teacher, whoever their caregiver is. And that caregiver serves as a buffer mm-hmm. for that child in buffering the impact of that stress and letting the child know it's going to be okay. And so how we respond to kids is absolutely foundational and fundamental and a real starting point.
So that if a parent, a caregiver, responds to a stressful child by modeling, and I'm going to turn, may not the right terms, I'm yeah. just what kind of being in control, relax, calming down, thinking about, breathing, whatever it is that calms you down, then that child's going to learn one way to respond to stress versus a parent who start screaming and crying and frustrated and yelling and, have their own stress and so forth. So that child sees a different way to respond to the same experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A big part of it is that's kind of social learning, Yeah, they're mimicking the parent. But also independent of that, the caregiver's response serves as a buffer. So the child's both learning how to deal with the distress, but also cueing off the parent's distress. In pretty powerful ways. So
there are attempts to take children who have significant consequences of early, multiple, significant adverse consequences that have got into the mental health system, and you all are now adapting standardized programs to try to change outcomes.
Absolutely.
What's the evidence that works?
The evidence? Well, we have a clinical outcome study that shows that done at our trauma center that shows that good trauma-informed mental health intervention improves outcomes for kids. We looked at a couple things. We used something called the Child Behavior Checklist to look at parent-reported behavior concerns mm-hmm. and saw dramatic decreases in those. I think if a parent says their kid's doing better, that's mm-hmm. evidence for me.
Right,
And we also looked at placement stability. So we serve a lot of kids who are in the foster care system. We know that if kids, we can improve placement stability, we'll improve long-term outcomes. So that's some of the evidence that we have. There's also, you know, we're building on a lot of a whole body of research around trauma-informed care.
There's an email that I think we've kind of alluded to the answer pretty clearly, but let me get it out there anywhere. It says, hi there, enjoyed learning from the program today. Often people think of trauma as a big event or an active happening in life. However, could the trauma be from parental absence or neglect or parental alcoholism? Would this affect the child any differently from what you're currently discussing? Thank you. So if you don't mind, answer the question, but explain why that might be the case.
Absolutely. You know, neglect is the most common form of child maltreatment. And sometimes people will dismiss neglect as sort of less impactful than other types of maltreatment like physical or sexual abuse. But the data is pretty strongly suggests that that is not true. In terms of long-term outcomes for kids, neglect is as impactful as physical abuse and even sexual abuse. Serious and persistent neglect is. So some of the things that we think that are happening with neglect, when you think about trauma as something happening, in neglect, it's often about something not happening, which is that kids are not getting the care and attention, the opportunities to learn that they need, and that has an impact that's as big as some or as significant as something actually
happening.
So
they're not learning how to address stresses or traumas or adverse
right.
effects, and they have to figure it out on their own, and that may or may not be good.
Yeah. In a situation,
adaptive.
When kids are experiencing neglect, you know, that mediator, that protective role that the parent plays in stress is not there.
It's absent.
Yeah.
So in the sense they have to learn to protect themselves.
Yeah.
However they might learn to do that emotionally or physically or whatever.
Yeah.
And again, all of this, I think it's very important to understand how all this can affect learning. If you're spending all your energy, you know, coping with all this dysfunction that you've been around, then you're not going to generally be that good in school. Yes, you might be brilliant. Yes, you may be overcome it for a while, but it has impact on us from a learning standpoint.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's see. Carolyn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, hi. Well, first of all, thank you for doing this program. If I'm listening to everything going on, you're the only one I've heard that even addresses this issue. The culture that we have of just getting over it, you know, snap out of it kind of approach to things, I'm wondering, are we learning from other countries as to how they do things? I've heard one time that bullying is a rarity in many European countries. And then lastly, the issue of appealing to people where they live, and many times our leadership doesn't see anything unless it has a dollar sign attached to it, and the opportunity costs would seem to be huge in this country for what we are having to pay on the back end of this neglect as a culture.
Well, before Josh answers this, let me answer your question with a quote that somehow appeared on my paper here. It says, quote, "It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." That's Frederick Douglass. That's what you're saying, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and obviously, if it's Frederick Douglass, this has been going on for a long time, and we haven't dealt with it effectively.
Yeah, we've been thinking about it. Yeah. Well, let me let Josh answer the question. So,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for the call. So, are we learning? Do we need to learn from other countries? Why is this a unique problem here? Are we getting better?
Well, I mean, I think what the caller stated really compellingly is that what we do in the first couple years makes a big difference. And it doesn't just make a big difference in terms of improving outcomes for kids. It makes a societal difference. And there actually has been some research looking at, the caller talked about the economic impact right. of early childhood trauma experiences. Right. And right. Pew Charitable Trust did a study that conservatively estimated that child maltreatment costs us at least $124 billion a year in direct mm-hmm. costs. Mm-hmm. A sensitivity analysis that looks at the total cost it estimates it to be closer to about $500 billion a year. And where we see those impacts is sometimes places we wouldn't expect. We've talked about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. We know we're going to see those costs in the healthcare system, but we also see those costs in corrections because of the relationship between trauma and increased rate for risk mm-hmm. for incarceration. We see those costs in lost productivity mm-hmm. Due to illness and other sorts of things. We see those costs in terms of increased child welfare costs, increased educational costs, in our education systems, and increased childhood health care costs. So the mm-hmm. There's sort of a growing understanding that this is, if you're going to invest, this is the time of the life you want to invest in.
Just at a meeting with you, actually, in Girdwood, where this whole issue was being discussed under the rubric of the first 1,000 days and the importance of it. And there was a gentleman who was there from the Chamber of Commerce, I believe in Juneau, I can't remember exactly. And the Chambers of Commerce are worried about inability to get sufficient workers to handle the jobs that we are requiring people. And this gets back unbelievable. They're looking, what we were talking about is they're putting their focus on education and school. And I'm sitting there talking to them and says, yeah, well, we're talking about the first 1,000 days yeah. of life and trying to make things better from the get-go so we don't have to invest in all of this downstream. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, when you think about workforce preparation, you don't think about preschool as your first an obvious target. But the data says that if you invest there in early education, you actually see greater impacts later on down the life right. span than you'd expect. So,
mm-hmm. Lynn, you're on line one.
Hi, folks. I'm a blind individual. I've been blind all my life, and I grew up in New York City. And, I wonder if there's any, and I've done a lot of work on trauma and disability, and I've been trained to train others on it, but I believe that everybody with a disability has been traumatized one way or the other. My mother just died on last Sunday, and she had a traumatized life, but I didn't really realize as much before she got dementia that she was traumatized in her own childhood. Plus, my parents both had mentally ill parents who were in the mental health system. What is the consequences of both my parents from Jewish extraction, being in the mental health system, and having two disabled kids too.
All right. Josh.
Well, a couple things that I think about. One is that when we think about our understanding of adverse experiences and traumatic experiences, we sometimes talk about that as though those experiences occur in isolation. And one of the things that you point out is that we have to understand the relationship between adversity, traumatic experiences, and the whole person and all of who a person is. And it's a part of the kind of field that people are just developing more awareness about, which is things like what happens when people experience disabilities and also experience adverse experiences or traumatic experiences, and how does that impact folks?
Yes, and just the fact that my mother just died at 85 last Sunday, but I think that I used to think it was my fault if she was miserable when I was growing up because I didn't have any context,
Yeah, that's.
Now I realized.
That's where things really get complicated because we as humans often assume some of that responsibility for everything that's happening, which may not be very good for your own mental health, is how I would interpret that. Again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not anybody that's really specifically trained in that, but you hear that so often, particularly in children. that of kids, of families that are going through divorce. They don't all assume that, but it's very common to ask children if they feel guilty about what's happening to their parents. And most of the time, I'd say the answer I get is yes, very commonly.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And I have a social work degree myself, and I've been interested in the trauma issue for a long time. So thank you very much.
You seem to be pretty well adjusted yourself.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Lynn. We've only got a couple of minutes. There's one quick phone call or email that I wanted to answer. It says, do children going through divorce, when they're moving back and forth between two households where parenting styles are different, does that have an impact on learning? And I think it can. It just depends on the situation, how well the parents are doing it. It's nice if the parents can really try to be as consistent as they can. But I would argue that many kids can see the difference. What you don't want a lot, I think, is a lot of argumentative parents, a lot of difficulty between the parents and being able to communicate, because that's just what parents would learn, is that's what parents do when they grow up, is they don't get along. And it certainly can affect behavior. And how do you tell the difference in that situation between stress-related conduct due to all that stress in that relationship and defiant behavioral disorder? And I don't know how to answer that real easily. I think that's why we have mental health professionals to help us make the right decision about solving it. So I wish we could answer that question a little bit better for you. But, Josh, we got a minute or so.
Yeah.
What do we want people to be sure they've heard today?
Well, you'd asked me a question about intervention and resiliency, and I'd said, helping caregivers manage our own response to kids. There's really three other quick things. Attunement, which is tuning into kids and understanding the world from kids' perspectives, is so, so critical. A third thing that I think about a lot is consistent response, which is responding to kids in ways that help them understand us adults as safe and predictable, and the world is a safe and predictable place. And the fourth thing we think about a lot is building routines and rituals into kids' lives so that they experience the world as a safe and predictable place where they can be successful and know what's coming next and engage the world and learn and do the business of being kids, which is about learning and developing. So those are some of the common things that I think are good for all kids, but particularly important for kids who've experienced adverse events.
All right, so just remember that our children are watching and learning from everything they see, and as Josh said earlier, probably the single most important persons involved in that learning is his caregivers, his or her caregivers, particularly parents. So
yeah.
What you're doing, how you're acting, how you handle problems, how you handle your own stress are important models for what children are picking up, in addition to what Josh has said, that we all benefit from early in life. Josh, this is probably one of the more important programs I think we've ever done. Hopefully we can get at it again, and let's have some other people listening. I appreciate your taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Warren.
My thanks to today's guest, Josh Arvidson, the director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center at Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. And if you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to be discussing applied behavioral analysis. That's a very well-documented way to improve education and management of children with autism. Our guests are Rebecca Parento of the Alaska Center for Autism and Susan Lesko of the Connecticut Center for Child Development. So why not tune in and learn more next Monday at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Plack is our web editor, and Dave Waldron, it was our audio engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.